So, in case there's so many people here, in case you've come to the wrong course, this is the class on tenets. It's a philosophical subject. It's like chewing dry bones. So if you thought this was something else, I was just teasing. I think you all know where you are. So as we often do, almost all of us, we're going to begin with some meditation to calm our mind, because this is a Buddhist course, not just in theory, but also in practice. So relax your body, sit upright, relax your mind, which is a more difficult proposition. Let go of your worries. Make it all be attended to later. Actually, all the things that we're worried about don't exist the way that they appear. They're like dreams. So in the same way that you can hopefully let go of your dreams after you wake up, let go of those worries right now. Just observe your breathing, but with the added factor of a little bit of discriminating awareness that recognizes when you're breathing in, when it's changing direction, when you're breathing out, when it changes direction again, and so forth. And in focusing on that, let go of your other thoughts. When you're first beginning, if you notice your mind completely going off onto other thoughts, remind yourself to bring it back to the breathing. You have to observe the breathing long enough to have it as a familiar object in order to constitute the generation of the mental factor of mindfulness. Mindfulness takes an object that you're familiar with and holds it. So watch it. And then keep it in mind. See if you can notice a difference between the turning point of the inhalation, just when you've breathed in and you're about to breathe out, and the turning point at the end of the exhalation, when you're just about to breathe in. Are they the same duration, same quality? with the mind a little bit calmed, follow one breath, inhalation, as though it were going up to the crown of your head, down to your throat, as you breathe in, down to your heart. Just leave your attention there and let go of your attention to the breathing. Instead, turn away from the outer objects to the inner mind, the mental consciousness, and watch it. At the beginning, that might seem to be dominated by the objects of that mind, the images, the thoughts that are coming. But turn your attention away from the thoughts, defocus on the thoughts, and try to perceive the nature of the mind that is perceiving them, the clear and knowing entity. You're not perceiving the eye consciousness. Actually scan to that for a moment and say, this is not what I'm going to pay attention to. Not the ear consciousness. Not the nose, tongue consciousnesses. Not the tactile consciousness that's perceiving the presence of your body, the breeze, so forth. Not that. The mental consciousness within which you think, plan, remember. Try to focus on the nature of the mind as being both clear. That's the main thing you're trying to notice, its clarity in the sense of being immaterial, reflective, illuminating, non-obstructive. Thoughts can come and go within it, like a vast space. And also be aware of its capacity to know, because that part of the mind that's watching the mind is knowing, understanding something. Watching the sky, temporarily clouded perhaps, but those clouds have to be inhabiting the space of the sky. We can't be there unless the sky is unobstructing. So even though the clouds might be temporarily still present to your sight, your mental consciousness understanding that there's space there. Here, when you defocus on the thoughts in the mind, they no longer are going to have a longevity to keep on appearing. They start to disappear as you take your attention away from them, enhancing your perception of this clear light nature. As our senses are not fully withdrawn, as our sense consciousnesses are still functioning in this beginning stage of concentration, you may be distracted by sight, something that your eyes are seeing out of the bottom, if your eyes are partially open or your ears are hearing, but particularly what your body sense is sensing, the seeming irrefutable existence of the body. That's appearing to your mental consciousness as a thought. Like these other thoughts, it is perceived by the mental consciousness, which is clear and knowing, that appearance of the body within the mind could only exist there if the mind is clear, immaterial, unobstructing. Defocus on the appearance of your body and refocus on the consciousness that's knowing that particular thing, the body. Let the body disappear. It's not enough to do it just once. Body will appear again. You have to do it again and again and again. If you're successful in letting go of the body, also notice that there may still be a perception of yourself as an observer. That too is appearing to your mental consciousness, slight dualistic appearance, as though there is the self-observing the senses, the in this case, the mental consciousness. That too is just an appearance, thought. To diffuse that, try to perceive the consciousness that's apprehending that, that's cognizing, knowing that. And go even further. Recognize that the image that you're building up through these experiences is a mental image of the consciousness, of the mental consciousness, which is just an approximation of it. And say to yourself, this too is just an appearance to my consciousness. And as though trying to perceive the actual consciousness itself, not just an image of it, let go of that mental image of the mind and try to perceive the consciousness that is perceiving it. If you get lost along the way, where are you? You're thinking, what am I supposed to be doing? Notice that whatever is appearing to your mental consciousness are like clouds or birds in the sky, like fish in the ocean. And re-enter your apprehension of the consciousness itself, the subjective mind, rather the objective thoughts. First by noticing the space between the thoughts, using logic to recall that even where the thoughts are present, there has to be consciousness. We're simply asking yourself to focus on the subjective mind rather than the objective thoughts. Again and again, let go of the content of the mind other than being clear and knowing. Because that's the only thing that remains constant. There's a continuity of that clarity and knowing, whereas the thoughts come and go. They might have some durability at the beginning because you've fed them for a long time, something you're worried about or excited about, but they fade. example is given by some of the great meditators in India. Like a ship at sea might send out birds to see if they come back. If they don't come back, they might feel that they're close to land because the birds would have alighted in the trees of that land and not come back. So sooner or later, whatever your mind is engaged in, you know, thoughts that might appear to it, sooner or later you come back to that calm, clear state, no longer involving yourself in the thoughts. Don't feed them. Don't feed those thoughts by attention, and they begin to disappear. In one sense, even though you're putting strong attention on this, it's very relaxing because you're reminding yourself to just let go. Let go of any content, any thoughts, attention to them. What you're left with at the end is an apprehension of this clear light nature of the mind, clear in knowing. This is our precious treasure we always have in every life, but are oblivious to it. We ignore it because we're so caught up in the objective thoughts and the outer objects of our senses. This clear light nature is our potential to become enlightened. We can get rid of all the faults within it. None of the faults are embedded in that so that they can't be removed. They're all adventitious, simply arising because of causes and conditions. So thinking that this observation was taught by the omniscient Buddha, his dharma, this is to recognize this Buddha potential. And also his dharma reminding us that this opportunity to observe it and to transform our mind is very rare and fleeting, because we have a human life of leisure and endowment which is impermanent, changing moment by moment. Definitely we have to leave this life. Whatever else we might achieve, friends or wealth or power, strong body, beautiful body, all of them will change and decay. We have to be left behind. We can't take them to the next life. All that we can take is the Dharma imprints in our consciousness. Well, also negative imprints if we were not to follow the Dharma. That's the only thing that we can leave this life with. So thinking this year, this month, this day, this next period of Chinese New Year, I'm going to try to be introspective, watch my mind, practice the Dharma to do some ultimate healing, not just superficial healing of some illness now, but to heal ourselves from attachment, anger, self-interest, low self-esteem, putting ourselves down, pride, jealousy, leaving imprints of our work on that so that in future lifetimes we will start off somewhere along the path. I'm going to participate this morning in order to reach a goal of healing so that I no longer harm others, and then to go beyond that to heal ourselves in positive ways, to develop up positive potential, positive qualities of love and compassion, concern for others, and ultimately wisdom that puts everything in perspective. I'm going to listen to the teachings, participate in order to become enlightened, to become Buddha for the sake of all living beings. And then relax. Bring your attention back to the present. How was your meditation? Okay. Up and down. Sometimes you had concentration, sometimes not. Okay, it's good observation. So, what's a good example? I don't know. What is a big sport here? Golf? Do people golf? Maybe guys do. Do you golf? No. Okay. Tennis? Squash? Squash. So, you know, you may practice for some time and get your swing, but then in the actual game, you may forget that and be, you know, doing something awkward. So it takes some continuity, some repetition to get familiar with letting go of the thoughts. In worldly pursuits, we don't mind, you know, doing things again and again. Here sometimes we get frustrated because in meditation we may feel it's more elusive, but it's the experience of those who have meditated that indeed you can, you know, you can train the mind like this. So not to be discouraged if the mind goes up and down. Is it a little bit better than when we first started meditating? Seems like it, right? Yeah, I hope so. So not to be discouraged about that. Anyone else? How is your meditation? This gentleman. Yeah. You didn't have many thoughts, okay. So that's a good sign? Yeah. I mean, were you falling asleep? No, okay. I mean, one might say I didn't have any thoughts because I fell asleep, but you were alert, so that's good. Yeah, go on. Yeah. Yeah, also I walked to the, what's it called, Marina Barrage? Is that what it's called? Yesterday. I'm an old guy. It was a long walk. So during our meditation, I was feeling some pain here also. So I tried to let go of that. And after some time, sort of disappears. Maybe you can rearrange your leg, stretch a little if there's something that you can't just continue through. That's good. Good observation. How was your meditation? Very comfortable. Okay. Okay. So, good. Okay. So I wanted to just to mention something before we start the actual substance. There is a subject in Buddhism we call the Four Reliances. Have you heard of that before? Four Reliances? What are the Four Reliances? Yeah. in definitive meaning of those words, not the, just the interpretive meaning of those words. And then... Right? Did you hear what he said? To rely finally on a non-conceptual, not just a conceptual understanding of that. Yeah. So nowadays there's so many things that are trying to get our attention as to propounding the some kind of spiritual path. Sometimes you can tell pretty much they're aimed at trying to sell you something, you know, like some internet course or something like that. And so you have to be able to, first of all, differentiate between your attraction to the person. The person might seem very charismatic. Do you know that word, charismatic, charisma? Charisma is something almost as though it's some karma that that person had generated in the past that collectively we feel in their presence, you know, like someone, and also manifesting maybe in their attractiveness or the, you know, the their smile or their apparent success in the world and so forth. So rather than taking that kind of person as the basis for your entry into the Dharma, to rather than relying on that person, rely on what they're saying. Listen to their teachings. So not to be attracted to their, you know, due to their charisma and maybe the apparent success. Oh, so many people are coming to hear her teachings or his teachings or something like that. So it doesn't mean you should ignore them completely, that anyone successful is not, that's not the meaning, but you know, don't rely on that. You check what they're saying. And then listen to the words, what they're saying. So don't rely on the mere pleasantness of the words, the what do we say, euphony, the sort of the poetics of it, or the beauty of the words, or it, to the extent that those words accord immediately with your wishes, like telling you, oh, it's okay to kill, it's okay to, you know, drink and smoke. Oh, these are good things. That might be something that your inner baby self, you know, is happy to hear, like a little kid hearing, oh, it's okay to eat as much chocolate as you want. So don't rely on just the superficial nature of the words. Check their meaning, what they're saying, whether that accords with the Dharma that you understand. Of course, you may not know much Dharma when you're looking for some teaching, but rely on the words, on the meaning of the words, not just on their superficial appearance. And then that meaning, you shouldn't rely simply on the, Jeffrey said, on the interpretable nature of those words, but on the definitive nature. So what does that mean? That's getting into quite deep subject. Not just the superficial meaning of the words, but in their, what are they getting at? What's the deep import of those words? And generally what we mean in the Mahayana, that means whether those words are leading you toward a deep understanding of selflessness and emptiness, the definitive meaning of those words. And then finally, not to just depend on a conceptual understanding of that. This is along the way. So if those words are leading you to an understanding of selflessness and emptiness, not ultimately to depend just on a conceptual understanding of that, mental image of that, but to keep on striving and have a non-conceptual direct perception of that. Those are called the four reliances. So the first one is probably where we're at now. Just, it's good to remember that, because there's so many teachings that are presented to us. There's so many systems and, you know, what was it? I don't know if he's still around. There was a fellow in America many years ago called Tony Robbins. Did that ever become popular here? Did you hear of Tony Robbins in Russia? Yeah? Even recently, you think? Yeah, he's still, I guess he's still around. He was like a, you know, big, tall guy. Would you say charismatic? Yeah, sort of, you know, personality, big white smile, white teeth, and looked very confident and had all these people around that were sort of like supposedly successful disciples of his. How much does a course cost? So that's a million rubles, right? No, I'm just joking. Rubles still good. So sometimes charging a lot of money and so forth. So you have to listen to what they're saying and listen to the words and analyze those words as to the meaning, whether they really have a lot of substance and so forth. So that's what I'm getting at. Okay, so this course is talking about the four philosophical schools that are recognized, particularly in the Tibetan tradition. It wasn't something that from the very beginning Buddha said there are four sets of philosophical tenets, but they became recognized. Amongst his teachings, various of the disciples over periods of time held their own philosophical understanding of what the Buddha was saying from having heard his discourses, having read the scriptures and so forth. Basically, we could say in terms of tenet and practice, there were, you could say, two main Buddhist schools, the Hinayana schools, and I say multiple because there's multiple variations of that, and the Mahayana schools of tenets. If we divide them down a little further, we were talking before that explaining that the Hinayana, basically we could divide into two main groups, those which were called the Vaibhashikas. This is by theory, you might say, or philosophy. The Vaibhashika system, which we talked about before, and the Sautrantika system. So you might say, oh, that sounds strange. I heard that the Hinayana was divided into the Shravakayana and the Pratyeka Buddhayana. You know, the Shravakas, those that were looking for their own, searching for their own nirvana. The majority of the Buddhist disciples in the time that he gave the sutras. And then there were the Pratyeka Buddhas, those individuals who had originally studied with some Buddha at some time, maybe multiple Buddhas, but then sometime made a firm decision that in the future they wanted to do it by themselves. Maybe they were fed up with being directed by a Buddha or something, but they were what are sometimes translated, Pratyeka Buddha, sometimes translated as solitary realizers. So different meanings of solitary meant, you know, sometime just by themselves alone, but solitary in the sense without the appearance in the world of a teaching Buddha, a universal teacher. They were going to, in the world when they came back as a human, they were going to meditate like that. So you might think, what are you talking about? Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, I'd always heard of solitary realizers and Pratyeka Buddhas. Who can explain why there's no contradiction? What are we talking about here? Where's my friend? That's the fellow. There he is. I can just see you back there. Don't hide. Yeah. So, did you hear the question? You heard part of the question. So, Hira said that the Hinayana tenets are divided into Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, but most of us have heard that the practitioners, when we divide the Hinayana, we divide into Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas. Is there some contradiction? Good. Okay, I'm not sure you're on the same wavelength. Generally, if we say Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, we're dividing up the Hinayana, we're dividing them up in terms of theory or philosophy. Generally, one can be a follower of some philosophy or tenet, but actually practicing something else. Like say, for instance, we might consider ourselves to be practitioners of Mahayana tenets, maybe the highest one we want to say, or we practice the Prasangika Majjhimaka. But that's the tenet that we hold, the philosophical school. But in practice, we may not even be practicing as a someone who has real renunciation or attempting to have renunciation. We may not even be Hinayana by practice. So there's a difference between philosophy and practice. You need some philosophy theory to be able to practice, but that's not enough. You have to be able to practice. So what we're talking about now are these philosophical schools that define the practices of these schools, whether you engage in them or not. Okay, so we talked about the Vaibhashika before. The Vaibhashikas, there were said to be as many as 18 different sub-schools of that. One of the prevalent ones, in fact, the present-day Theravada was one of those 18 sub-schools of the Vaibhashika system, generally. There was another school of the Hinayana that was a slightly more sophisticated view, at least from this survey of the various philosophical schools, that's called the Sautrantika. You know the word sutra, right? S-U-T-R-A, or in Pali, S-U-T-T-A, right? Sutta, sutra. So this word, S-A-U, Sautrantika, comes from the word sutra. And it refers to one of the etymologies is that it refers to the fact that this philosophical school basically based its tenets on the sutras. Not that the Vaibhashikas didn't. Vaibhashikas did mainly rely on a text called the Mahavibhasha, this great detailed exposition, kind of like a huge text. I think it still exists in Chinese. I mean, the translation exists in Chinese. Did any of you ever encounter that? I'm not sure what it would be called in Chinese. I don't know if it was ever translated into Tibetan. But the Sautrantikas mainly depended on the sutras, and also there's another way of calling them Sautrantikas in that, or those that are related with the sutras, because the Vaibhashikas believed that there were the seven texts of the Abhidharma Pitaka. Do you remember this? The three baskets or Pitaka. What were they? The Vinaya Pitaka. What was the second one? Sutra Pitaka, the Abhidharma Pitaka. That meant, in a sense, all of the Buddha's teachings, if you were to think of them as material, could be deposited into one of these three baskets. Like if you're collecting leaves, say, put all the green leaves in this basket, all the yellow leaves in this basket, all the red leaves in this basket. Can you imagine that? Just, you know, you're collecting. Do leaves fall from the trees here? I'm not sure. Maybe you don't know what I'm talking about. In America, in autumn, the leaves fall from the trees. Do they fall from the trees here? Yes or no? All year long they fall. All year round, okay. Do you have to rake them up sometime, collect them? Maybe burn them. So you can imagine. So as though the Buddha's teachings were somehow material, all of his teachings about discipline, or let's say the first of the three higher trainings. We talked about the higher training of morality or ethics yesterday. All of those teachings collected were considered to be the Vinaya Pitaka. The Vinaya is a Sanskrit word that means discipline. And it doesn't mean when you practice discipline, it doesn't mean that like you're the school teacher looking at the class to discipline the class. That's not what it's not like when you practice discipline, it doesn't mean you're disciplining others. Who are you disciplining? Yourself, your own mind, right? Your own bad habits and so forth. It has nothing to do with it, like strict teacher frowning at the class or something like that. So all of the Buddhist teachings that were ultimately talking about how to develop the stabilized states of mind, how to control the mind on a basic level, basically were called the Sutra Pitaka. Even though all of the individual discourses, it's sometimes confusing, all of the individual discourses were called sutras, right? Even the teachings of the Vinaya, they were called, the individual discourses that were put in that basket were called sutras, that means discourse. The Sutra Pitaka were basically those sutras that had to do with concentration, the second of the three higher trainings. And the Abhidharma Pitaka were from all the Buddhist teachings, those that emphasized higher wisdom, ultimate truth, so to speak, were put in this basket, the Abhidharma Pitaka. So the Abhidharma Pitaka, according to what the texts that existed at the time when these philosophical schools began, sometime after the Buddha's death, sometimes hundreds of years later as the schools evolved, these 18 different Vaibhashika schools, the texts that they had for the Abhidharma Pitaka were seemingly, they had authors that were of the various disciples of the Buddha who were supposedly arhats. They weren't, their Abhidharma Pitaka weren't regular kind of sutras. They were texts that were supposedly composed by arhats having heard the teachings of the Buddha. So all of those seven, there were seven main texts in the Abhidharma Pitaka. Even today, you can find them enshrined in our translations into Chinese and Tibetan. So of those texts, the Abhidharma, the Vaibhashikas accepted them as all the authentic meaning of the Buddha, even though the text didn't say, you know, that it was a discourse by the Buddha. It was teachings by the arhats, supposedly, who had heard the teachings of the Buddha and were explaining his teachings about Abhidharma they had extracted. So they accepted that as the word of Buddha. The Sautrantikas said that these seven texts were not authentic, that you should draw the Abhidharma from the rest of the sutras, from the Sutra Pitaka and the Vinaya Pitaka, that these seven texts, not only were they not spoken by the Buddha, if you look at those texts, there were many errors in them. So the people who wrote them probably were not even arhats, even though they were attributed to Shariputra and others who were known to be arhats. Okay, so various reasons why the Sautrantika, a little more discerning than the Vaibhashika. So the Sautrantika itself was itself had different sub-schools, two main, rather than the 18 of the Vaibhashika. The Sautrantika had two main divisions. Those that were what are called followers of scripture, and those who were followers of reasoning. What does that mean? Have you heard that before? I noticed you're nodding your head. So who were the followers of scripture, the Sautrantika followers of scriptures? What scriptures did they follow? Oh, okay. You have to be careful if you nod your head. I may say. Okay. Do you remember? What scripture mainly were they relying on? Amitabha? Was it? What was she saying? Amitabha? This is the name of this center, right? Amitabha Buddhism? No. You're looking for some hint. Okay, so I'll help. So I think the followers of scripture, mainly, if you talk about scripture, they were mainly following Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha. And you may say, well, where did that come from? Abhidharma Kosha, do you remember we said Vasubandhu, one of the two brothers, he and Asanga were brothers, had the same mother, different fathers. Vasubandhu originally was a practitioner of the Hinayana and scoffed at his brother's, Asanga's practice of the Mahayana and criticized it. Later, when he changed, he heard the teachings when Asanga was reciting them during one, you know, time when he would recite all of the Mahayana scriptures. And he realized that this was good words, the true meaning, and so forth. And he regretted his previous criticism of the Mahayana. And in order to purify that, he composed this text called the Abhidharma Kosha. It's said that if you memorize Abhidharma Kosha, it's one of the powerful ways to purify a negative karma of abandoning the Dharma. Because that's what he was doing when he was criticizing the Mahayana. Even today, people revere that. So what was the Abhidharma Kosha? It was talking about the Vaibhashika system, but from the point of view of the Sautrantika, as though a Sautrantika teacher were teaching you the Vaibhashika system. And in certain places, it wasn't always apparent, but in certain places when the Vaibhashika position was in radical opposition to the Sautrantika position, the sentence would have some ending. I don't know what it is in Sanskrit, but at the end of the sentence, it would have the syllable L-O, lo, la, naro, lo. Generally, a sentence would, like say, if the last letter of the sentence in Tibetan ended with a syllable M, ma, let's say, this Tibetan syllable ma, after that you'd have, to show it was the end of the sentence or end of a paragraph, you'd write a similar letter with an O above it, mo. But without doubling the last syllable, without being similar to the last letter, you'd write lo. The implication was, so they say. Sort of like, yeah, right. How would we do that in English? I think I talked about this before. We might put some sarcasm in our voice, you know. You know, they say that there are, you know, there are arhats that fall from the state of arhatship. Yeah, right. I mean, you know, you might state, or you might be very subtle. There was just this subtle thing. So the Sautrantikas, who are followers of scripture, mainly are followers of Abhidharma Kosha, Vasubandhu's text. So again, that's talking about the Vaibhashikas, but it's pointing out, indicating the difference between the Vaibhashika and the Sautrantika with these various subtle implications, right? The followers of reasoning, do you know who the followers of reasoning? What did they follow? They followed mainly these two great logicians, Dignaga and Dharmakirti. Who was first? Okay, you heard. Dignaga was the teacher. Dharmakirti came later. Which one of them? One of them was a disciple of, direct disciple of Vasubandhu. Do you know? Dignaga himself. In fact, I can't remember how it came about. They said, maybe later scholars said that there were several of Vasubandhu's disciples who excelled him in various subjects. And Dignaga was said to excel Vasubandhu in logic. And so the texts of Dignaga and the texts of Dharmakirti were considered to, the followers of those were said to be much more discerning and in use of logic and dispelling wrong ideas. So of the two Sautrantika schools, they are considered to be slightly more elevated. So we have 18 Vaibhashika schools, and above those, the two Sautrantika schools, the followers of scripture and the followers of reasoning, right? Make sense? In case you have chance, I'm reading from, using as a basis here, the Jeffrey Hopkins exposition, very brief exposition, because we just have a few weeks to do all this, in his book, Meditation on Emptiness. So if you happen to have that book, it's just coming around page 344. So the Sautrantikas are of two types, followers of scripture, mainly of Vasubandhu's treasury of knowledge, that's the Abhidharma Kosha. And then the other school, two types, the followers of reasoning, mainly of Dignaga's Pramana Samuchaya, the compendium of Pramana, which they take to be valid cognition, and Dharmakirti's seven treatises on valid cognition. Dharmakirti wrote one famous, of those seven, one of them is the Pramana Samuchaya and the Pramana Vartika. So of seven texts he wrote seven big set of seven texts. Even the Tibetans still study those today. But one of the most important was the Pramana Vartika. So they depended mainly on those. The latter, that is the followers of reasoning, are considered to be higher of the two because of their resemblance to their Mahayana counterparts, the Chittamatrans. Huh, so that's interesting. So Dignaga and Dharmakirti wrote these logic texts mainly from the point of view of Sautrantika, Hinayana tenets. But later, both of them are renowned to have written texts in the Mahayana. And of the Mahayana schools, they mainly were talking about the Chittamatra school. So implicit in their teachings was, in the same way that Vasubandhu's text was talking about the Vaibhashikas, but implicitly you could understand, especially from his auto commentary, you could understand it was talking about it from the Sautrantika point of view. Dignaga and Dharmakirti, although ostensibly talking about the Sautrantikas, were they themselves, one of their higher points of view was the Chittamatra school, which was Mahayana, not just Hinayana, and had higher philosophical view of things. So these followers of reasoning are said to be similar to their Mahayana counterparts, the Chittamatrans following reasoning. So the next school that we'll talk about later, because we still have, after today, there's still four more classes, we'll be talking about the first of the Mahayana schools, the Chittamatra, the mind-only school. And there, there are followers of scripture and followers of reasoning. So their followers of reasoning also depended on Dignaga and Dharmakirti's texts that were explicitly talking about the Mahayana. Also, the Sautrantikas following reasoning are called so because of their resemblance and because of their assertions on the processes of reasoning being more developed, more than the Sautrantikas following scripture. So this is kind of interesting because we mentioned before that if a doubt would come to your mind, why are we spending all this time talking about these lower tenets which are wrong, supposedly wrong, some of them right, but some of them wrong, why not just teach the highest one? Because all of these were at various times the interpretation of people from the Buddha's teachings. Some of the statements the Buddha said were taken by the 18 Vaibhashika schools and interpreted that way. also the Sautrantikas interpreted it in their own way, the Chittamatrans, the Majjhimakas interpreted it in their own way, but would be seen later and later to be finer and finer, corrector and corrector understandings. Can I say that? Corrector and corrector? Better, better and better understanding. More correct understandings as you got higher. Our tradition is called the Gelugpa, right? Of the four Tibetan traditions, none of them are associated with any of these philosophical tenets. I mean, in the sense they all ultimately accept the Prasangika, but they're not four schools like the Vaibhashika, you know, higher and higher schools. We have the Nyingma, the oldest school, the Sakya, the Kargyu, and the Gelugpa. So our teachers are of that Gelugpa tradition. The Dalai Lama is a member of the Gelugpa tradition. The Gelugpa order of Tibetan Buddhism is fond of Dharmakirti's logic. Dharmakirti, right? Especially as described by his Sautrantika followers. So when we first begin studying the philosophical schools in the monastic tradition, we start from the very beginning mainly studying the Sautrantika tenets from the point of view of the followers of reasoning. In fact, the very first text they study at the monastery, does anyone know what the first text is called? Very first text? Dura. Collected topics. That's what the young boys debate. What is the color of a white horse? Is a white horse white? You debate. You know, you learn definitions. Okay, what is it? Is a white horse white? No. White is a color, as an object of eye consciousness. Eye consciousness only perceives shapes and colors. A white horse is not white. A white horse is a person. It's a sentient being. It happens to have white color. So, I mean, there'd be things like that where they're a little bit word play, but making the debates interesting, learning definitions, mainly drawn from the Pramana tradition, from the tradition of Dharmakirti and Dignaga, talking about these, you know, using logic and so forth. So they were all, and for instance, the course that we're still in the midst of talking about, mind and mental factors that we're teaching Tuesdays and Thursdays, was called If Mind is Chief, Who Are Its Accomplices, or something like that. And the previous course, when we talked about the ways of knowing, those are part of another subject matter of this collected topics called awareness and knowing. And that's all from the Sautrantika point of view. You might have remembered when we were talking about this, all from the Sautrantika point of view, remember? It's all, so, so the Gelugpa order of Tibetan Buddhism is fond of Dharmakirti's logic, especially as described by his Sautrantika followers. They see the Sautrantika system of another one of the particular disciples of Dharmakirti and Dignaga called Dharmottara. So Dharma Uttara, you put together Dharmottara, sort of ultimate Dharma, I guess you'd say. That particular person and his other disciples, they see these teachings from the Sautrantika as stepping stones to understanding the Mahayana. Because Dharmakirti and Dignaga had their feet in both streams, so to speak. They wrote texts about the Sautrantika system, but they themselves were practitioners also of the Chittamatra. So that Jeffrey pointed out that this liking for those Hinayana tenets, the Sautrantika tenets by the Gelugpas and others, you know, the Nyingma, Sakya, and so forth, that can show you that there was no, you might think that the Hinayana was something inferior and despised, only practiced only studied the Mahayana. That's not the case. They studied all of these as like steps on the staircase that can get you up to the highest philosophical view. Whereas I don't think in the Theravada countries that they study the Mahayana generally. Maybe some gurus do, but the Mahayana, as it was presented in Tibet, did study and study very deeply. Even the lowest one, the Vasubandhu's text, Abhidharma Kosha, after one had finished all of their Geshe studies, at the very end of the highest class of the Geshes, the Larampa Geshes, like Ken Rinpoche, Geshe Juni, he has the Larampa Geshe degrees, like different, there are different levels of Geshe. There's a very pinnacle. At the end of their studies, they spent even as many as 7 years going over the Abhidharma Kosha and Vinaya, which are drawn from the Hinayana. So there's great appreciation of that. So I said, the followers of Scripture, the Sautrantikas following Scripture, their tenets are similar to the Vaibhashikas. However, along with the followers of reasoning, they don't accept that objects of the past and the future are instances or examples of substantial entities. For the Vaibhashikas, generally they would say that something of the past, something of the present, and something of the future all exist now as some kind of substance, have some kind of substantial existence. Whereas the now, starting with the Sautrantikas, they say, that's not true, that only objects of the present have any kind of substantial existence. And that's one difference. The Sautrantikas also differ from the Vaibhashikas in not accepting that there are any arhats that fall from that state. Not all the Vaibhashikas accepted that, but that in general, remember we talked about the Vaibhashikas said that there were six kinds of arhats of various qualities. Generally, the other tenets, when they talk about the arhats, they don't talk about some arhats being better than others. You know, you could talk about their past, but when they reach that state, the state of arhat is one that has ceased all the delusions and has wisdom that counteracts self-grasping and so forth. But the Vaibhashikas believe that there were six kind of arhats in terms of their quality, five of which might fall from their realization. And we talked before in class how that from the upper tenets, from the Sautrantika point of view, those five that fell could not have been arhats, because once you have ceased the delusions from the root, when you have a true cessation, those delusions will never come back again, so you can never fall from the state of arhatship. So they don't accept that a foe destroyer can fall from his attainment or her attainment. All Sautrantikas agree that the seven treatises of Abhidharma, the higher knowledge, were not uttered by the Buddha. And most add that they were not even uttered by foe destroyers, because the foe destroyers would not have set forth mistaken teachings, such as that of the substantial existence of space. So that's one of the things that's mentioned in these seven treatises of the Abhidharma, that space has some kind of substantial existence. Upper tenets say that space is a mere negation. It's not talking, the different kinds of space, the word akasha or namka in Tibetan, we talked about this several times. There is a kind of space called intermediate space, is what we see between objects, and when we look at the sky. That's not the real meaning of space. The space which is the mere absence of obstructing contact, although you might say, oh, I see that here, I see there's no contact. You don't see there's no contact, no obstruction. You infer that, and your mental consciousness can know there's no obstruction here. That is, that kind of space is the one that we use in analogy to emptiness and so forth. And when we talk about the clear light nature of the mind, I said it's unobstructing like space. You know, that kind of space is called uncompounded space. So the Vaibhashikas believe that also has a kind of substance, substantial existence. I keep on having flickerings of something I want to say, but it hasn't come back. It comes up each time, and I can't remember. So Trantikas say that space, analytical cessations and non-analytical cessations are mere negatives or absence of tangibility, absence of afflictions and so forth, and thus are only imputedly existent, though permanent in the sense of being non-disintegrating. So what does that mean? There's a famous line in the Abhidharma Kosha that says, permanent phenomena include space and the two cessations. There's one line. Did you ever memorize any of the Abhidharma Kosha? I tried once to memorize some, just thinking that to memorize that text is supposed to help to purify the negative karma of abandoning the Dharma in past lives. Remember, because Abhidharma, Vasubandhu had criticized the Mahayana, abandoned the Dharma. I didn't get very far. Little boys, 5 years old, could memorize the whole thing, but it's a relatively, you know, good chunk to remember. So there's one line in there when it's at the beginning of the text, it's talking about that which the Vaibhashika accepts as permanent, space and the two cessations. So the true cessations means the kind of cessations we usually think of when you remove something completely from the root so it'll never come back. That's called analytical cessations. That's how Jeffrey translates it. And then there's another kind of cessation which is not a true cessation, but similar, when you use the temporal antidotes to cause something to disappear. It's called a non-analytical cessation, like You use meditation on love as an antidote to anger, your own anger. Your own anger cannot be present at the same time as love if you're concentrating on love for others. So that anger or hatred is ceased, but that's not called an analytical cessation, because once the love, you forget about the meditation on love, anger can rise again. Okay, it's not ceased from the root. So they say that the Trantikas say that space, analytical cessations, and non-analytical cessations, the two space and the two cessations, are mere negatives or absences of tangibility, absence of the afflictions in the case of analytical cessations and so forth, and thus are only imputedly existent, though permanent in the sense of being non-disintegrating. Also, Trantikas also assert that cause and effect cannot be simultaneous. Okay, here's another difference. The Vaibhashikas say that there are cases when a cause can be simultaneous with its effect. What's the general situation of cause and effect? Generally, a cause comes after its effect? Good. No. First you have a cause, like the seed, then you have an effect. So the Sautrantikas the Vaibhashikas even postulate something called simultaneously acting cause. Some kind of cause which was simultaneous with its effect. And so there was also a corresponding simultaneously acting effect, which is simultaneous with its cause. So Trantikas would not accept that. they can't be simultaneous. Cause always comes before the effect. And they also say, the Vaibhashikas had this interesting theory that consciousness, even the eye consciousness, for instance, actually perceives its object directly without rising in the image of the object. So in the case of a mental consciousness, we talked about that consciousness arising depending on the mental image in the consciousness, right? A conceptual consciousness. But even the senses, the sense consciousness, let's say the eye consciousness does not, we would say, the eye consciousness doesn't go out from the eye and actually touch the thing that it's seeing, right? It actually arises in an aspect of the thing that it's seeing. In the case of the eye, there's a reflection and a refraction in the back of the eye, due to light going through the lens. Like, say, if you're looking at a parrot, there's an upside-down parrot on the retina, right? That you probably learned in school. And that the eye consciousness arises in that aspect. That's what the Sautrantikas would say. Whereas the Vaibhashikas say the eye actually perceives its object by coming in contact with the object. So the Sautrantikas do not assert that a consciousness, they assert that a consciousness does not perceive its object nakedly, but is generated in its image. On these points, the Sautrantikas disagree with the Vaibhashikas and agree with the Mahayana school of tenets. So they're considered higher in that sense. Also, the Sautrantikas postulate, and we studied in our low rig, a particular kind of awareness called an awareness to which an object appears but is not ascertained. What did we call that? It was a colloquial way of calling that. Inattentive perception, right? Inattentive perception, like you're concentrating on the World Cup. Does Singapore ever get to the World Cup? No? Oh, don't laugh. That's not impossible. Might happen. I mean, America, I think America got to the World Cup at one time. Before, they never played. So I said, if you're watching the World Cup and someone is telling you, oh, the meal is ready, but you're so focused on this, all of your mental attention is paying attention to that, that the sound actually appeared to your ear consciousness. Your ear consciousness actually, in a sense, heard it, but your mental consciousness was not paying sufficient attention, and it remained inattentive. You weren't paying attention to it. Your mental consciousness only has the capacity to attend to various things, like we were talking the other night. It can multitask a little bit. In fact, if you're watching the game and you're not so totally involved in it, you might have heard that. Oh, dinner, huh? Or lunch, snack. So that's another thing. The Sautrantikas believe that. Do the Vaibhashikas believe in that kind of... Sorry. What am I talking about here? The Sautrantikas believe in something called self-knower. Leave that. I'm not sure whether the Vaibhashikas believe in inattentive perception or not, but what they don't believe in is this particular kind of consciousness called self-knowing awareness. That's what I meant to be saying. With Tibetan, we say Rang Rik, self-knower. When we studied Lorig in the previous weeks, we talked about the Sautrantikas postulate or theorize, or part of their tenets is an assertion that there is the ability of every consciousness to know the fact that it is conscious of something. That self-knower is not knowing, let's say, the self-knower in an eye consciousness is not knowing what the eye is seeing. It's just knowing that when the eye is in the process of knowing something, like shape and color, that consciousness knows something, is knowing. The Sautrantikas postulate this, but the higher tenets, some of them, the very highest tenets, do not accept that. Remember, that was the example of a sword cutting itself. They say that just as a sword, one edge of a sword cannot cut itself, mind cannot know itself. But we postulated in our meditation on the mind, we said that one part of the mind can pay attention to the rest of the mind, especially if it's paying attention to a previous moment of the mind, right? Because cause and effect can't be simultaneous. So that's not that kind of observation is not called self-knower. Self-knower is simultaneous with the knowing, let's say, of one of the senses or of the mental consciousness. Interestingly, the highest school doesn't accept that, nor the lowest of the schools. The Vaibhashika doesn't accept that. So there are a couple of situations like that where the Vaibhashika assertion is sort of contradicted by the other schools above it until you get to the highest school, which agrees with it again. Kind of interesting. Another one? Do you know another one of those that's like that? What we talk about non-revelatory form, revelatory form. Non-revelatory form is something the Vaibhashikas postulate. It's like this. If you make a vow not to kill, let's say you make a vow to the Buddha, even you make a vow not to forget your change when you go to the bus the next day or something, but particularly if you take a vow, you create a subtle kind of matter, material, that is not obvious to others. It's not revealed by your form. They look at you, they don't see that you've made that promise. But it is form. They call it non-revelatory form. Have you heard that before? Mm-hmm. So, for instance, the vows of monks and nuns, the vows of lay people, are vows of all 10, abstaining from all 10 non-virtues? Do you abstain from all 10 non-virtuous actions? Remember the paths of non-virtue of killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, blah, 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 blah. There's 10 non-virtuous actions? Yeah. You think so? Is that right? You abstain from all 10 non-virtuous actions? No. The Pratimoksha vows are only vowing to abstain from actions of body and speech because they are form. Because when you take that vow, you create a non-revelatory form which, like a dam, keeps water, like what was it, the Barak Dam or wherever I went yesterday, keeps the water from moving. It has some, the non-revelatory form can help you to avoid creating that negative action. In a sense, you might say, oh, it's just something that's like a memory of, you know, oh, I shouldn't do this. But it's something which is an actual physical form that pervades your body. And those with clairvoyance, even though it's non-revealed to ordinary sight, those with clairvoyance can see that or know that. They can know that you have vows on your continuum, or they can know that your vows are broken by seeing whether that revelatory form is there. So that non-revelatory form does not impede actions of mind. Why not? Because mind is immaterial. Actions of body are form, physical. Actions of speech are physical. But actions of mind, because the mind is immaterial, non-obstructing, right? It's of a different nature. When we talked about the three kinds of impermanent phenomena, we said there's matter, consciousness, and that which is neither, which is impermanent, but neither matter or consciousness. Like, say, the person. Person is also impermanent, but neither matter nor consciousness. So the mind is immaterial. It's not matter. It can't be stopped by that revelatory form. So the vows of monks and nuns, the pratimoksha vows in general, do not include prohibitions from mental actions. If you have the thought, you haven't broken your pratimoksha vow. You didn't know that. Or now you're thinking you did know that, but you forgot. Okay. So that's another difference. So the Vaibhashika accepts that, and most of the tenets, the Sautrantikas don't accept that. Maybe some of the other schools don't accept that until you get to the Prasangika, which again says that that is indeed the case. What about the Bodhisattva vows? Do you create a non-revelatory form there? Usually in the texts, they don't pose the question that way. They don't say whether the Bodhisattva vow creates a non-revelatory form. They just say that the Bodhisattva vow includes abstaining from actions of mind, like malice and abandoning sentient beings and so forth mentally. So it's of a different level. If you make that vow, my supposition, I haven't seen this written. My supposition is that you still create a non-revelatory form that will help you in abstaining from those of the Bodhisattva vows that are physical, but it won't help you in abstaining from those of the Bodhisattva vows that are mental actions. And so those have to be abstained from by conscientiousness and mindfulness and so forth, I think. The Sautrantikas, are different, along with the Vaibhashikas, are different from the Mahayana schools in that the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika believe that objects external to the mind truly exist. In fact, that's one of the big differences between the Mahayana and the Hinayana schools. There's a belief that although there is a person, the person is devoid of being permanent, partless, and independent. The person is devoid of being self-supporting, substantially existent. But they say the person does exist, truly exists, whereas Mahayana says there is a person that is imputedly existent, but it does not truly exist. That's one of the big differences. That phenomena, and further in the Mahayana, the Mahayana say that phenomena external to the mind do not truly exist, whereas generally in the Hinayana tenets, the Vaibhashika and the Sautrantika, phenomena external to the person, other than the person, like cup and so forth, they are said to truly exist. The Hinayana schools, the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, also do not assert that phenomena other than persons are selfless. So they don't say this is empty or selfless, except in this kind of weird constructed way that this cup is not the object of use or enjoyment by a self-supporting, substantially existent person. So in that way, it's selfless. But just from its own side, it truly exists. Does that make sense? Have you heard that before? No? No, you haven't heard? Who said no? You haven't heard that before. Okay. So they don't generally say that phenomena are selfless. But in some of the philosophical texts that talk about selflessness in the Hinayana, they say, you could say this is selfless in that it's not something that a selfless person would enjoy. There's no self who can enjoy this. No self-supporting, substantially existent self who can enjoy this. So therefore, it's without a self, which is a subject of it. Also, the Hinayana tenets don't accept that there are, both the Vaibhashika and Sautrantika, don't accept that there are obstructions to omniscience. Remember, we said that they talk about a kind of obstruction, afflicted obstruction, that the Buddha gets rid of, that allows him to see or her to see. Well, generally in the Hinayana, they would say he, right? Generally in the Hinayana, to achieve arhatship, you have to be a bhikshu. Have you heard that? I'm not sure whether Achan Brahm teaches that or not. Generally in the, maybe in some of the tenets they don't, but generally in the general Theravada, that's why if one is practicing, one might actually even change one's gender mentally. It's possible to change one's gender just by mental activity. Nowadays you have to go through some expensive operations, right? Gender, what do they call it? Gender transition. What is it?
Gender migration.
There are many cases. There's even a vow. There's even an example in the Vinaya that if you break your vows as a bhikshu, you can't take them again. Nowadays, it's a little more liberal, lamas. But say you broke your vows, but if you change your sex, you can become a woman. You know, what else? Generally, you change to woman, not to what's in between, hermaphrodite or something. You change to woman because only males and females can take vows. Those that without clear gender or that with both genders cannot take the vows generally. So you become a woman, and then you can become a bhikshuni, even though you broke your vows of gala. Now you couldn't take the vows again as a bhikshu. Now you can take the vows of a bhikshuni. Then if you break those vows, this is very naughty, I'm not sure what it was, you could become man again and you can take the vows again. But after that, you can't change again and take vows. If you break the vows again, you can't change. So there was recognition at the time of the Buddha that this was something that occurred. Of course, there were also communities of people that were, you know, in India, still today, there are people that dress as women that are men, there are women that dress as men and so forth. But we're talking about people that actually changed their sex. So generally it's said that to become an arhat, you need to be, in the Hinayana tenets, you need to be a bhikshu, so you need to be a male. So the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, after a long period of time, would always appear as a male, according to them. But according to the Mahayana tenets, that's not the case. Women and men are exactly equal in their capacity to achieve liberation, arhatship, or to achieve enlightenment and so forth. So the Hinayana schools do not accept the existence of the Sambhogakaya, the Buddha's enjoyment body. Although the Hinayana schools accept that there is something called the Bodhisattva, that Shakyamuni was an example of over three countless great eons, there was a path that he tread and that he achieved that state. But they don't accept the existence of one of the bodies of the Buddha called the Sambhogakaya that teaches the Mahayana doctrine forever, because they say that one of the four seals, remember the four seals? What's the first one?
Awe.
all compounded phenomena are impermanent. So they say Sambhogakaya is compounded, so it must be impermanent. So how could it last forever? How about that? Isn't that a good reason, right? How could it last forever if it's compounded? So there's a difference here. The same words in Sanskrit, generally we translate as takpa in Tibetan, means permanent. That can also mean eternal. Like when the Vedas, they said the sound of the Vedas was eternal. Do you remember we talked about this? You were here yesterday. We were talking about this. The Vedas, the Indian, there are various what we might call Hindu schools that all arose in dependence on the acceptance of these ancient scriptures called the Vedas, which were talking about truth. You know, what was ultimately true and so forth. And it was one of the propositions, one of their tenets was that the words of the Vedas, this truth was enshrined in words which were eternal. The same word also means impermanent. So from a Buddhist perspective, there's a difference between being impermanent and eternal. Like say, for instance, our mind streams have existed since beginningless time until now. Not our gross mind stream, this one right now, but our subtle mind, sort of in any one life, when our mind enters into a fertilized egg, let's say, if it's going to be born from an egg or from the womb, enters into the fertilized sperm and ovum of a mother, let's say, then at that point, that subtlemost mind expands into a gross mind that, like, we recognize this lifetime. What we're experiencing right now is just a gross consciousness. At night, that gross consciousness absorbs, subtler levels of consciousness arise. At the time of death, also, all of the gross consciousness of that life absorbs, and something subtle continues on that doesn't remember being, you know, who you are now. Doesn't remember being Jeffrey or Sui Kim or George or anything. That subtlemost mind has existed since beginningless time into now and will exist all the way through Buddhahood into the infinite future. So that's something that's eternal, but it's changing moment by moment. Every moment of the mind arises from a previous moment of mind. So this example is something which is eternal and impermanent. How about something which is impermanent but not eternal? That's pretty easy. This mug, I'm not going to drop it on the floor and demonstrate that it's impermanent. Or that it's, let's say, it is impermanent. We know that it's not only instantaneously, subtly impermanent, that it's changing moment by moment, but we also know that it will have an eventual demise. It will be broken into pieces and so forth. So as it has subtle impermanence, that's similar to the mental consciousness, but it also has something called gross impermanence, that it will be destroyed, like our body. And so it is not eternal. Is this body impermanent? Yes. Is this body eternal? No. This cup is impermanent, but is not eternal either. So there are phenomena that are impermanent but not eternal. So what did we have? Impermanent and eternal. We talk about four alternatives between two things. Something which is both, something which is neither of the two, something which is, say, A but not B, B but not A. So if we take impermanent as A and eternal as B, something which is both would be like our mind stream, both impermanent and eternal. something which is neither impermanent nor eternal, what would that be? Is there such a thing? Pardon? Yeah? Sky flower, a non-existent phenomena? Not impermanent, not eternal. I guess you could say that. I was thinking of something that does exist, though. Anything existent that is not impermanent and not eternal. So if saying not impermanent means it has to be permanent, sky flower doesn't work for that. Anyway, so something which is permanent but not eternal. How about this space within this cup? So you might not have heard of that. You might not have analyzed that before. Generally, we say space is the lack of obstructing contact, right? So what we see within this cup is, say if the cup is empty, it happens to have water in it right now, but say if it were empty, that is not the space I'm talking about. I'm talking about the lack of obstructing contact within this cup. So we're localizing one particular thing. I mean localizing, not the cup can move, so the space within that cup also moves. But when the cup is broken, what happens to the space within that cup? Pardon? It's gone. Well, you have to think. How about this? It's similar. This cup, ultimate nature is emptiness, right? We believe from the higher tenets. The emptiness of the cup. Did the emptiness of the cup exist before the cup was cast or made? It came into existence when the cup was made. When the cup is destroyed, is the emptiness of the cup continued to exist? No, because the emptiness of the cup means the non-inherent existence of the cup as it appears to consciousness. When it's no longer appearing to consciousness, we don't refer to the emptiness of the cup, even though emptiness in general continues to exist. Same thing with the space within the cup. If you think about it, the space within the cup didn't come into existence until the cup was made, and it will disappear when the cup is destroyed. That's what's called a temporary permanent phenomena. It's permanent in that it's not changing moment by moment, because emptiness and space are permanent. They don't change moment by moment, but they're not eternal. It's something that exists for a certain amount of time. So what do we have? Something which is both neither permanent nor eternal. How about, yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. I said the space within the cup. That means, you know, if you look at the empty, where you pour the water, that area, that volume rather, that it, generally we say there's space in the cup. Oh, can I give you some more coffee? And you look in your cup, it's empty. You say, yeah, there's space here. Or your stomach is empty, yeah. Can we eat some more food? Yeah, I've got space. In your car, there might be space in the car for another rider. The Italians have an expression like that. There's always room for one more rider in the car. There's always room for one more guest at the table. Very sweet, isn't it, Italians? You have something like that? So we're talking about the empty space here. And then upon that, we can understand there's the lack of obstructing contact within that, the really real meaning of akasha. Not talking about the space within the ceramic or whatever this is, the shell, whether it be clay or ceramic or metal or wood or whatever. I'm not talking about the space within that. I'm talking about the space defined by the outline of the cup. That has only come into existence when the cup was created, and it will go out of existence when the cup is disintegrated. Like the shunyata of the cup doesn't exist. Composite space. There is a compounded space. That's what we usually say, the space that you can see, like the space you can see in the cup. That's generally what's called, the Tibetans call barnang, intermediate space, what you see between things, what you see within the boundaries of the cup. That is compounded. That changes. Yeah, that changes. But the real meaning of space is what's called uncompounded space. So there is a compounded space. It's interesting that maybe some of you haven't heard before. There is a compounded space, but the real meaning of space, when we talk about it, is the real meaning of akasha is uncompounded space, the mere absence of obstructing contact. Even though you can see the basis of it sometimes, you can see that there's no obstruction here. You are not seeing uncompounded space. You are seeing the compounded space, the intermediary space, the space in between two things. Between here and that pillar, I can kind of see, like seeing the water in the tank. But you're not seeing the uncompounded space, because that's permanent. That only is known by the mental consciousness. Okay. Yeah, basically I was saying, giving an example of something which is, first of all, we said, which is neither impermanent nor eternal. Because the space, the uncompounded space within this cup, or the shunyata of this cup, both of them are permanent, so they're not impermanent, and they're not eternal. Remember these four alternatives, I said, both A and B, neither A or B, A but not B, B but not A. So what is something which is impermanent but not eternal? Well, that's easy. The cup itself. Right? It's impermanent, it's changing moment by moment, but it has an end. What is something which is eternal but not impermanent? Non-compounded space. Or no, let's say the emptiness of the mind. The emptiness of the mind. Because the mind is eternal. If I just said the emptiness of the cup, that would be permanent but not eternal. Okay. So these two words, permanent and eternal, sometimes are confused. You might think that one is the other. So the Hinayana tenets do not accept that there is an eternal, there is some bhogakaya that lasts until the end of samsara, because they're saying all compounded phenomena are impermanent. They don't accept that something will exist for, let's say, eternity like that. They're confusing the words. For instance, the teaching that a Buddha's enjoyment body, the Sambhogakaya, abides forever without disintegrating contradicts the first seal that all products are impermanent. Well, the Mahayanas say that the enjoyment body does disintegrate moment by moment, yet its continuum remains of the same type, unlike an ordinary body which becomes sick, old, and so forth. Thus it is immortal, eternal, but still impermanent. Okay, so there are many contradictions of the Hinayana, of the Mahayana tenets. Okay, so this is a little introduction. We'll, next class, which will be, I think, after the new year. I'm not sure. We'll do a little review again of the Sautrantika and then go on to the Chitta Mantra. But it, just today, any questions that you have? Yes. Wait, he's going to bring a microphone because your voice is so gentle. So quiet.
Sorry, Venerable. Because with regard to the female woman becoming an arahant, right?
With regard to the what?
A little bit louder. The arahants not only are males, because they can be nuns also, because the modern arahant, there's one arahanta, Machikel, K-A-E-W. She became an arahant in this lifetime.
Oh, I was asking the other day whether anyone knew anyone was renowned as being an arhat. So this is, there's some arhat. Which country?
In Thailand.
In Thailand.
Yes.
So one lady.
Lady.
Who's believed, lay or lady?
She's a nun.
She's a nun.
Yeah,
who's believed to be an arhat. Right?
Yes, because she actually attained the jhanas, and then but she thought that she already gained enlightenment because she was in bliss and full, just in, you know, bright radiance. So she said that she already achieved enlightenment. So she told her master, Arahanta Mahabowa, who is actually the disciple of Arahanta Man, about this. Mm-hmm. And then the Arahanta Mahabowa told her that this is not enlightenment. But she has a great psychic power. She can communicate, go to heaven, go down to hell, and communicate with all the animals. And they will kind of tell her, ask her for help, because, like, for example, there's one cow who was spirit, the consciousness of a cow who was slaughtered, who has just been slaughtered, and he came to ask her to eat his meat the next day, because they will offer her the meat, you see. So she said so the cow consciousness asked her to transfer marriage to him when she eats the meat. And he says human beings are very, very cruel. He has worked slog for the master all his life, but at the end when he was old, the human just slaughter the cow. So the cow says that because of their consciousness, they will be born as animal for many, 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 many lifetimes, because they are, their consciousness is all about being themselves, being cows or whatever animals. So, but anyway, basically is so the cow consciousness asks Arahanta Magic Cow to eat the meat and transfer merits to him, and many of these beings will come to her to ask for merits, sharing of the merits. So anyway, she always travel, and then the Arahanta Mahabowa told her, you have to stop all this nonsense and focus on the meditation. So he told her that the bliss that you see is not permanent. That is not enlightenment. So when she...
The bliss or the glow that
Yeah, because the radiance is all just consciousness of brightness. So Arahanta Mahabowa asked her to focus on the brightness. Then she realized that it shimmers. It wavers. Then she realized that is not enlightenment. So she continued to meditate, and eventually she realized that there's no observer, because she used to think there is an observer.
Okay, now wait, is this a long question or is it a statement?
Sorry, I just want to share with you about Arahanta Machikel, because she's an arahant. Yeah, I can pass you her bibliography.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So, oh, I don't know. Were you saying merits can be transferred?
Transfer of merits.
Okay. Generally, you know, there's two different concepts here when we talk. And this famous thing comes up a lot. I'm going to take a picture of you all in a minute. So I'm waiting for different people to get back. Different people are going to the bathroom. I want to take a picture. Some people just got back, other people just left. So there's something called, what is your name?
Isip.
Saying something about transference of merit. That's something that's talked about sometimes in the Hinayana scriptures that might be confused with the Mahayana concept of dedication of merit. Okay? So dedication of merit is different. Dedication of merit doesn't mean that the merit I've created, that I dedicate to you, and it sort of becomes part of your legacy, you know, sort of within your mind stream that you will experience in the future. That sounds like what's meant by transference of merit. As Joy was saying, very often right, not every time, and also me, I'm not always right, but she's often right. She's saying that generally in the Mahayana, we don't accept, well, even in the general Theravada teachings, they don't accept that the karma created by one person can be experienced by another. So I can't transfer my merit, the virtuous karma that I've created, to you. It can only, that which I create, can only be experienced by me. Okay? I can interact with you. I can create, say, for instance, there was a tradition in Tibet when the Kadampa Lamas died, the followers of Atisha, they had property in common, communal property. So the monks would take that property that the monk used to have, his bowl and so forth, which they had partial ownership of, and they would do puja. They would buy substances, and they would create karma thereby that the person would benefit from because it was their property in common. So different ways that we can affect others by doing puja like that. But yeah, that's what I'm saying. If you have karmic connection, also, say for instance, your family, if someone dies, if the family makes offerings in, you know, to their children or their karmic connected individual, that can affect that person. But generally, you can't transfer merit from one person to another. But I'm going to take everyone's picture for a second here. There's something here. Okay. Yeah. Oh, no, come on. No, hey, quit hiding. Hey. Hey, what's his name? Is it? I just want to hide. I didn't catch what was saying.
Every time after the puja, they were dedicate the merit, like, yeah, dedicate the merit. I have a question, you know.
Wait, she didn't finish yet. You're so eager. You didn't let her. So, I didn't catch her question. Joy, can you explain what she's saying? Okay, give back. Come on.
Okay. I have a question on the Sultan Tikka, actually.
Give back this microphone.
Because
we'll have time to talk later.
I really disagree that the merits cannot be shared with other sentient beings, because all our chanting in temples and at home, we were told and instructed by our masters to transfer merits or dedicate merits. It's called Huixiang. Maybe the understanding of transfer and dedicate merits, the meaning may not be exactly the same, our understanding of the words used. Right. But basically, it is to share with all the sentient beings our merits.
Okay, so here's the difference. from the general understanding of karma. Usually, there'll be a course on, I think it's only two lectures on karma. There are four general factors. One is that to understand karma more deeply. One is that that's related here. You can only experience a result if you have created the karma yourself. You can't experience a result unless you've created the karma that gave rise to that result. Because karma is a cause. The effect later is a result, you know, happiness or suffering or being born as a human or in the hell realms or whatever. So you can only ripen on the karma that you create can only ripen on your own continuum, that action. But we can dedicate merit for the benefit of sentient beings. How does that work? How does that benefit sentient beings? Because, again, the karma that you can create only ripens on you. So as you become more evolved, as you become more patient and loving, then if you've dedicated it to all sentient beings, in particular to someone, when you encounter that person again, you will be able to, you have a karmic connection with them with relationship to this karma that you created. So you'll have a particularly beneficial state of mind because of having created that virtue in the past, and you will benefit them. It doesn't mean that you will benefit them right now from a general Buddhist point of view. You can do other things, though. You can, to help them, you can request the protectors of the Dharma, for instance, with whom we have closer karmic relationship than with the actual deities. To actually pray to Avalokiteshvara or Amitabha, maybe our karmic connection with them is very distant, but with the manifestations of the omniscient mind that are called protectors of the Dharma, the Dharmapalas, and their retinue, there's a closer, because they have sort of worldly aspect, you know, and because they appear to various spirits as very powerful, those spirits that are actually not enlightened, mundane, will follow them. So if you give in, if you make offerings to the Dharmapalas and request benefits for someone who's sick, the Dharmapalas, again, a little bit distance, but their retinue, who follow their lead, ordinary spirits, will also, those of them that are under their power, so to speak, will also try to benefit. So from a Buddhist perspective, this is an interesting question, because this same word, transference of merit, or phrase, transference of merit, I've seen come up in other contexts, and I've often, you know, wondered about that. I haven't seen a particular article or section in a book, because generally in the Mahayana, you see the Tibetan texts that we read, they don't talk about transference of merit, because that's something, that phrase comes from the Theravada tradition. So I'm not sure if that was originally meant to mean a dedication and just translated that way, or if it's a completely different word. But as we're 6 minutes over,
okay,
right.
Sorry.
Now, and I know that some people have plans for today.
Sorry, with regard to the why is okay. It she can transfer, okay, because sure. She ate the beef, his meat.
Right.
Again, that's why that one nourishes her body, again, so there is merits in there. That's why okay. She can dedicate
so
the merits.
So we do the same thing in yeah. In Buddhist, right, Mahayana Buddhism. Say for instance, generally in the Vinaya and the Vinaya, the monks and nuns are allowed to eat meat. Did you know that? Actually, in some Chinese countries, it's believed that, oh, if you're a monk, you have to be vegetarian. If you go to a Chinese restaurant, a monk eating meat is considered to be wrong, right? Because some of the Mahayana sutras such as, I'm not sure, Sutra Alamkara say that if you are trying to develop the Bodhisattva ideal, you should not eat meat. But it's not part of the Vinaya. In fact, when the monks and nuns were going for alms, they asked the Buddha, could they eat meat? They asked the great compassionate one. He said, if you did not ask for it to be killed, if you did not see it being killed, if you have no, if there's no evidence it was killed for you, you can eat that because the karma is sufficiently separated. If you go to the Chinese restaurant and say, I want that lobster, you know, that's definitely not to be eaten, right? Even by a monk, right? In the Mahayana, generally, you should try as much as possible to avoid eating meat. In Tantra, in the highest Vajrayana, there are instances when one can utilize, and when it was in a very high practice, you eat the meat, and because you're creating a karmic connection with the being whose flesh. Do you call this fish flesh also? And we, you know, fish or flesh that you're eating, you create a karmic connection with them. So your prayers to meet that person in the future, they having nourished you now, may in the future, when I encounter this being, may I be able to nourish them with the nectar of the Dharma. Like the Buddha himself. In the Jataka tales, one time when these five, cannibals came when he was on the Bodhisattva path. He was a king, giving away everything. They were in the line, and the ministers, they saw they were cannibals. They didn't want them to come up. The Bodhisattva said, no, let them come. And they said, we'd like to eat your flesh. He said, okay, just let me get the house in order, you know, my kingdom in order, and you can have my flesh next, you know, week or whatever it was. He said, but there's one prohibition. You have to promise never to eat flesh on full moon or new moon days, on the days when the delusions are more. That's when we take the precepts generally, full moon and new moon, right? When the monks and nuns make their monthly confession. So those five cannibals did that. He gave his body. And because of that, they were, and many other karmic connections over the many lifetimes, they were born as the five disciples to whom he first turned the wheel of Dharma in Sarnath and Varanasi. He was able to give them the nectar of the Dharma. That's what he prayed. So a little bit like that. So in the Tantra, when you take meat, making that kind of prayer. So it's, again, it's not transferring merit in the sense that the merit you create now is residing in that person's mind stream. Okay. So let's stop here with your permission, and let's just do a short dedication. Dedication of merit. if you want transference of merit, if you want to call it that. So how to think? Due to these merits, may I be able to benefit all sentient beings as I progress immediately, as I progress upon the path, as my mind gets less angry, less attached, may I be less a burden on people because it ripens on me, my control of my mind, and therefore may I benefit them. As I become less attached, less clingy, may I be, my relationships be more wholesome. And as I continue along the path, whatever way these merits ripen upon me, may they become the cause of my continued spiritual development, continually benefiting sentient beings higher in more subtle and beneficial ways until I become enlightened, when I can spontaneously and effortlessly bring sentient beings to their culmination, you know, to bring them to nirvana and enlightenment, all as a result of these merits. So in a sense, you're thinking, you might think of that as transferring, you know, the benefits of this. May that eventually end up within the lives of all these sentient beings. But it's not as though the merits that I'm creating has now been transferred into their mind streams.